Invite you this morning for an Old Testament chapter to the book of the Song of Solomon, chapter 5. We'll read into a little bit into chapter 6. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 32 says that Solomon wrote 1,005 songs. But this is the Song of Songs. That's what he says. So keep that in mind as we read through Song of Solomon, chapter 5, and into verse 3 of chapter 6. I am come into my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends, drink, yea, drink abundantly, O beloved. I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled, for my head is filled with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night, or my hair. I have put off my coat, she says. How shall I put it on? I have washed my feet. How shall I defile them? My beloved put his hand by the hole or the latch of the door, and my bowels or heart was moved for him. I rose up to open to my beloved, and my hands dropped with myrrh, and my fingers with sweet-smelling myrrh upon the handles of the lock. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. My soul failed. When I spake, I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. The watchmen that went about the city found me. They smote me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took away my veil from me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him that I am lovesick. That's really what that means. They answer, what is thy beloved more than another beloved? O thou fairest among women, what is thy beloved more than another beloved that thou dost so charge us? My beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000. His head is as the most fine gold. His locks are bushy and black as a raven. His eyes are as the eyes of doves by the rivers of water. Waters washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are as a bed of spices, as sweet flowers. His lips like lilies dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. His hands are as gold rings set with beryl. His belly is as the bright ivory overlaid with sapphires. His legs are as pillars of marble set upon sockets of fine gold. His countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Whither is thy beloved gone, O thou fairest among women? Whither is thy beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with thee? My beloved is gone down into his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He feedeth his flock among the lilies.
Matthew 7. Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to the brother, thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye, thou hypocrite? First cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn again and rend you. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. Or, what man is there of you, whom if his son ask bread, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he give him a serpent? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father which is in heaven give good things to them that ask him? Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Enter ye in at the strait gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way, which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns, or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them. Not every one that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man, which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And every one that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man, which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. And it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes.
I'm in awe of the opening. Matter of fact, I'm a little shook up. It's exactly what we're thinking of today. And I've been dragging my feet about the message, because I am so guilty of it. I'm guilty of this whole stack of papers here. Maybe the guiltiest one in the room. But now I know. Now I know that God has a message. And I just say I'm guilty. Right up front. In the early 1630s, a man by the name of Shah Jahan was the undisputed master of a vast subcontinent. Because of his warfares, he had gained a massive territory for himself. But all these victories and all these riches were hollow. And that's because his beautiful Persian princess wife had died in childbirth. Their love between each other rivaled storybook fables. When most men, especially kings in Asia, had harems, this man did have three wives. This woman was his chief advisor. She actually rode with child with him side by side in battle. They loved each other so much. And so when she died, he went into a chamber and he wept for her so loud in anguish that his servants thought he'd lost his mind. When he came out of the chambers in 8 days, his courtiers and servants were shocked. His jet black hair had turned completely white. He ordered his entire land in the morning. If you were caught smiling public, it was immediate execution. The Shah's sorrow, however, began to weigh on an entire nation. If you can imagine. And so the whole nation was put into this cloud of dismay. Just, there was nothing light. There's no smiling even allowed. And so the Shah changed his mind. He turned his sorrow into a frenzy of activity instead. And he imported the chief architects everywhere he could find and the chief craftsmen to build a monument like no other in the entire world to the memory and a mausoleum for his wife's ashes. More than 20,000 workers took 22 years and billions in today's dollars to build the most majestic building in the entire world. In memory of his wife, his love, centuries later, this monument still stands. It is still today considered to be the eighth wonder of the world. When the building was finished, the Shah ordered that the architectural plans be destroyed. He ordered that the architects themselves be executed and that the craftsmen have their hands chopped off so that there be no competition to his building. Perhaps you've seen pictures of this building. Some of you have probably been there. The building that the Shah built for his wife, Mumtaz Mahal, is the stunning and breathtaking Taj Mahal. The wife of a British officer was once heard to say, "I would gladly die tomorrow if some man loved me enough to put such a building over my grave." A poet from India once wrote that though the Taj Mahal only let this one teardrop, this Taj Mahal glistened spotlessly bright on the cheek of time forever and ever. But there's a little something you might not know about the Taj Mahal, and if you would ever visit it, it's not in your Indian guidebook. And that is, researchers have found that the ornate box that is supposed to contain the ashes of Mumtaz is empty. It's not there. And there's plenty of theories about why. And there's plenty of rumors about why. Did the Shah know? Did he bury her someplace secret on purpose? Now, nobody knows for sure, so I just had to select one that I liked because it fit the message. One of the more popular theories is that one day Shah Jahan visited his work site. And as he was walking around the building in its construction, he tripped over a box. And appearing clumsy, which he did not want to do, in his rage and anger, he ordered the box to be thrown away, and terrified workers actually disposed of her ashes. I like that one. Now, that story is impossible to confirm. I'm just saying right up front, that's probably not what happened. I did select it for a reason this morning. But one thing we know for absolute positive, the eighth wonder of the world does not contain what it's supposed to contain. We know that. Researchers have proven that. And so what I'd like to say is that somehow this frenzied activity became a focus, ending in a regal monument to a beautiful but very empty purpose, rather than the actual, original, and intended pursuit, which somehow became lost in all the frenzy of well-intentioned activity. That's what I'd like to say. Because I think we can say that for sure. In other words, it's really easy in life to get sidetracked. Is it not? And have a purpose. I mean a noble purpose. And get sidetracked with the purpose. What's most important to you? I mean, clear it all away. What is the most important thing in your life? And before you say God, I'd like to suggest something. I would like to suggest that our pursuits, whatever we're pursuing in life, is proof of what's most important. What we pursue in life, this is not going to be a good sermon. I'm warning you right up front. This is going to hurt because it hurts me to deliver it because I'm guilty. Our pursuits prove what's most important. And God knows. God knows. We ain't fooling anybody. We heard it. We're not fooling anybody in heaven because our pursuits are proving what is most important in our life. No matter what we say, if we say that God is the most important thing and yet we pursue other things, how are we not like the Shah, busy building a stunning endeavor that's supposedly dedicated to a subject we've largely forgotten and get really annoyed when we trip over him when he gets in the way. That's what I want to talk about this morning. What are we pursuing? Your family? Your beliefs? Being successful? Being respected? Being included? Being diligent? Being prosperous? Being recognized? Being envied? Being superior in an intellect? Are you pursuing happiness, tranquility, health, acceptance, prosperity, entertainment? What's it look like? In all honesty, cut the fluff. What does it look like? Today we want to look at three kinds of Christians. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 12 actually mentions six facets of possibility of what we look like to God. He says, you could build on that foundation. Now, if any man build upon this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or stubble. That's six facets of possibility pretty much going downhill of what our life looks like based on our pursuits. And then he says it's going to be judged with fire. It's going to be judged with fire. Dale Swearingen said one time, he said, it is always good to revisit the basics. This is a basic sermon, but it still cuts like a knife, I think. And so I'll just tell you right up front what the goal is for the sermon. It is simply to reconsider a more consecrated life. That's the goal. The title of the message is The Narrow Way. The Narrow Way. Very simple. There's 3 points to the message. Number one, a wandering damsel. Number two, the daughters of Jerusalem. And number three, the fairest among women. A wandering damsel. Invite you to turn back in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 34. Bible says that the Old Testament was written for our learning. And so we'd like to consider something I thought on a while I'd like to preach on, but it took a while to research, and it's a little damsel by the name of Dinah. And so we're going to kind of skip down through the story just to get the picture of what happens here, because I don't have time to read the whole thing. And just see if we can get a lesson from this wandering damsel. And so Genesis chapter 34, we'll read the first 4 verses here. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father, Hamor, saying, get me this damsel the wife. We're going to go down to verse 25 then, but in order for the sons, the other sons of Jacob, her brothers, say the only way you're going to marry our sister, they're tricking these men, is if you're circumcised and you become like us. And then we'll have an exchange rate with you, and your daughters and our daughters and sons and so on can intermarry. Verse 25, and it came to pass on the third day when they were sore from the circumcision that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon the Levi, Dinah's brother, and took each man a sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. And the sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. Verse 30 and 31. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, should he deal with our sister as with a harlot? I don't know what you think about this story. I mean, Jacob? Willing to sacrifice your daughter so you don't get hurt? There's a lot of faith issues here. And then there's a lot of family dysfunction going on. That's just the way I see it. You remember in the previous chapter right before when Jacob's leading his family and he sees his brother and he's scared of him because he comes out against him with a whole lot of men in their arms, and so he sets his family in an order that's the most expendable down to his favorites. And so this girl, they believe she'd been between 12 and 14 years old when this defilement took place. Right before this, her father has basically set her, she would have been right behind the servant. So you got all the expendable servants, and then she's a girl. The only daughter, I believe. 12, 14, she's up in front here. She's expendable. Now how do you feel about that? How do you think she felt about her father? What do you think about your dad if he says, you know what, I'm going to put you up here, you're expendable. And so you can see why she'd go see the daughters of the land. Jacob's been trading there anyway. Shechem was situated between two mountains. It was a pass. It was a trading center. It's mentioned many times in the Bible, even after the slaying. It's a valuable area, and so it probably would have set the fashion tones for the area. She went out to see the daughters of the land. The problem is she got defiled by the prince of the land. That's what it cost her. Now, I don't know if this is of any note to you, but the title of the city is Shechem, and the man that defiled her is Shechem. And so it behooved me to go look up what is the meaning of the word Shechem. And you're not going to find this very easy. Because it just means if you just have a normal etymology book, it's going to say shoulder. You got to understand what the shoulder meant to those people. And so the actual definition of the word Shechem, if I can find it here, means the seat of a person's interest. I don't know if that you find that interesting, but she went to the seat of a person's interest and was defiled by the very same thing. Just for what it's worth. So Dinah, for us this morning, is a picture of a worldly Christian. A Christian who looks around and desires satisfaction and fulfillment from the things around them. That's the lesson we can get from Dinah, or at least I get from this chapter right here. And because they're looking around, they become defiled by the very same thing. It takes advantage because there's a prince. There's a prince of that land. He's called the prince and the power of the air. And he'll defile you, even though what you're looking at is just the daughters of the land and what they have to offer. We're going to spend most of our time thinking from the concept, the mindset, that we are a spouse to Christ. And so this is going to be brought up throughout the whole message. We are to be wholly his, engaged to the Lord. And so what would this be a picture of? Would this be a person who's distracted from the espousal? That's a big deal. Have you ever looked at a young couple? We just had one get married. And it's not that the house is not important. It just comes second. Right? Each other is important. That is all they are pursuing is each other. Yes, we need a house. Yes, you need a house. Yes, we need a car. But you've got to admit, it pales in comparison to their eyes for each other. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's just not as important. Matter of fact, dad's probably working on the house about as much as the son is. Because it's not that important. And that's the way it ought to be. The most important thing is his bride. Yeah, he's got to have a job. But even when he's on the job, he's thinking about her. Because it pales. It's secondary. His number one pursuit is his bride. And so this is a picture of a person, this Dinah is a picture of a person that the pursuit has become more important. The young man gets focusing on the house and the wife comes in second. That's a problem. That's a problem in that marriage, guaranteed. Yes, they need furniture. Yes, they need a lot of things to start their life, but that's not the main focus. The main focus is each other. Their view of themselves, this Christian like this, is adventurous, enlightened, and free. They don't see themselves that way at all. What does the Bible say about that? 1 John chapter 2, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. And so if we're a worldly Christian, and we're caught up in this, which is the warning straight out of that right there, Then we be distracted with passions, possessions, and position. That's a serious problem. And he said, God's love's not there. That's a possibility. That's possibility number one for a broad road Christian. There's only two kinds. He said, there's a narrow gate, there's a broad gate. They lead to ways. Gates are something you go through by decision. This is, we're not talking about people who have never made a decision. We're talking about people that did make a decision. That's what a gate is. These are broad road Christians. John Piper. I am wired by nature to love the same toys the world loves. I start to fit in. I start to love what others love. I start to call Earth home. Before you know it, I am calling luxuries needs and using money just the way unbelievers do. I begin to forget the war. I don't think much about people perishing. Missions and unreached people drop out of my mind. I stop dreaming about the triumphs of grace, and I sink into a secular mindset that looks first to what man can do and not what God can do. This is a terrible sickness, and I thank God for those who have forced me again and again toward a wartime mindset. We're all prone to this. This sermon, I hope you don't go home and say, that was a good sermon. I hope you go home and say, God, help me. Help me. You know, the drunk and the glutton reach a point of fulfillment. They actually get enough. But a covetous man is never satisfied. You think about that. We read about the mote and the beam, and right there it is. You know what it is to be covetous? It means to be resentful or painful desire for another's advantage. It leads to envy, jealousy, resentment, and bitterness. The excessive desire for more than one needs or deserves. The opposite of contentment, a strong desire for something that belongs to another, a deep longing for something that God has not given you, looking around, becoming dissatisfied, wishing for what someone else has or is, doing how well off someone else is, or well, where someone else is in position. Covetousness is the most under-preached thing we have. You can commit any sin in a church and they'll nail you for it, right? You can be the most covetous man and go straight to hell and nobody said a word all the way there. It's serious business. To me, this is serious. When you look at it and you look at your life and you think about the things you wish you could pursue that somebody else is, that's covetousness. That's dangerous. Or you envy somebody else. Proof. It's easy to look at Dinah and say, how could you do that? She had her reasons. I'm sure she did. It's a lot harder to look in here and say, why are you doing that? And John Piper says it's really easy to do. Spurgeon said it this way. You're going to have to listen close to this. It's a little bit longer than what I'd like, but it is serious. It smote me. He said, brethren, I do solemnly believe that of all hypocrites, those are the persons whom there is of the least hope, whose God is their money. You may reclaim a drunkard, given, thank God we have seen many instances of that, and even a fallen Christian who has given away to vice may loathe his lust and return from it. But I fear me that cases in which a man who is cankered with covetousness has ever been saved are so few that they might be written on your fingernail. This is a sin which the world does not rebuke. The most faithful minister can scarce smite his forehead. God knoweth what thunders I have launched out against men who are all for this world and yet pretend to be Christ's followers. But yet they always say, it's not for me. What I should call stark naked covetousness, they call prudence, discretion, economy, and so on. And actions which I would scorn to spit on, they will do, and think their hands quite clean after they have done them, and still sit as God's people sit, and hear as God's people hear, and think that after they have sold Christ for poultry gain, they will go to heaven. Oh, souls, 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 beware, 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 most of all of greed. It is not money or the lack of money, but the love of money, which is the root of all evil. Did you hear the words? The scarce man that can be saved from covetousness could be written on a fingernail? That shocks me. Turn to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, we'll start in verse 13 and read a little bit here. And one of the company said unto him, Master, speak to my brother that he can divide the inheritance with me. And he said unto him, Man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? And he said unto them, Take heed and beware of covetousness. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. And he spake a parable unto them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? And he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall all these things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself as not rich towards God. I had to ask myself when this thought came, do I put the same effort in pursuing God as I do pursuing money? I mean, I'll get up early, and I'll stay up late if it takes it, and I'll sacrifice a lot of things I'd like to do for it. But what about God? What about God? When was the last time I took a day off? When was the last time you took a day off and just said, God, it's all yours? Where's our pursuits? Do we have enough or not? Most of us have it coming out of our ears. You don't have to turn in if you don't want, but 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul gives us some more advice. 1 Timothy chapter 6, starting in verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life whereunto thou art called. I'm going to skip down now to verse 17. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to share. That's what communicate means. Laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come that they may lay hold on eternal life. He didn't say that they weren't rich people. He didn't say that. He's talking about the desire for it. And he's saying that if you're not rich towards God in this thing, it is proof that you are pursuing the thing, the gift rather than the giver. It's proof. And God knows. God knows. Anybody have a problem getting sidetracked there? I do. I'll go first. I do. I have no problem working 5 days a week, and sometimes wish I could work six. No problem. It's a problem. It can be a problem. I'm not saying we shouldn't work. There's scriptures for that too. We're just looking at one way. Why? The pursuit. The pursuit. I don't know if you've ever heard of a man by the name of Charlemagne. His original title was, I believe, Charles the Great. His father has an amusing name. He was Pepin the Short. So you got Charles the Great and Pepin the Short. But Charlemagne was one of the greatest rulers post-Christ, I think you could say. He's the one that almost got the Roman Empire completely back together back in 768 A.D. He ruled the Franks, or modern-day France, from 768 A.D. He conquered the Lombards in 774. He became the emperor of the Romans in 800. And declared to be the Holy Roman Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Leo. This is a very famous king. Charlemagne was tall. He was strong. He had blue eyes. He had curly hair. He was handsome in all his features. And while he often dazzled the crowds in his robes, he liked to dress like a common soldier. He had a sword. I believe it was called Joyeuse. And this sword was so heavy that very few men could even wield the thing. And he liked to carry that around. He was so great, so rich, so brave, and so powerful that his fame spread beyond Europe, which, by the way, Europe is still, I believe, in the same design as he left it today. But it spread clear into Asia. The Caliph of Baghdad, as a token of respect, sent ambassadors to bring wonderful presents, a monkey, an elephant, an organ, a mechanical clock, and most of all the keys to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. This is what they said when he died, when this man Charlemagne died. No one can tell the mourning and sorrow that his death caused everywhere. Even the pagans wept for him as of the father of the world. You know, years later after he died, they opened up his sepulcher. Charlemagne was sitting on his decayed body, his skeleton was sitting on a throne. His crown was on his head. His royal robes were still around him. His scepter was leaning up against the throne, along with his favorite sword. His hand was laid on a Bible. His fingers were pointing to a question from Jesus. But what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? Or what shall it man give in exchange for his soul? I don't know if it's too late for that man, but his last message to this world was this: it's not worth it. And he had it all. He had it all. And in the end, it wasn't worth it. When's enough enough? When is it? Somebody tell me, I'd like to know. When is enough enough? What would God say about my pursuits? Do my pursuits bring me closer to Him? I'm not saying we don't have pursuits. You can read all the way through that Song of Solomon, and they talk a lot about gardens, and they talk about their surroundings, and I think it was special to them. And somebody owned it. And Solomon had a lot of stuff, but I can tell you that wasn't his pursuit. The question is does my pursuits bring me closer to Him? Or have I lost my way? That's the question. And I think it's a serious question. Isaiah 55, starting in verse 2, and I don't have time to go into this, but he says, why are you spending money on things that could never satisfy? Why? That's God's question. When I have it. The daughters of Jerusalem. Let's turn back to our chapter this morning that we read, so it's in front of us a little bit. Actually, we'll read just a little bit of what we've already read, just to get the context of this next thought here. It was kind of a new thought to me a couple years ago, and I actually didn't agree with it. I'll tell you why here. So Song of Solomon, chapter 5, we're going to read verses 8 and 9, I believe. It says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am lovesick. That's what that means. And they ask the question, what is thy beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? What is thy beloved more than another beloved that thou dost so charge us? Now, I don't know if you know who Hudson Taylor is. Now, he was the founder of the China Inland Mission. He spent 51 years as a missionary to China. And so this man was on the leading edge of what we would call modern-day missions, you might say. 51 years, that's a significant amount of your life to be spending as a missionary in China. But it's very interesting to me that Hudson Taylor never wrote a single book on how to do missions. That's interesting to me. Matter of fact, he only wrote one little book, I believe. I bought it. I shouldn't say, I was kind of disappointed. I thought it would be more or something. I don't know what I thought. I bought the book. It's called Union and Communion, and it's a commentary on the Song of Solomon. And I read it twice, and it just really made me scratch my head on his writings. But at the end of the book, there's this little excerpt, Who Are the Daughters of Jerusalem? And like I said, I didn't agree with him for quite a while. But I've since changed my mind. I think he's correct. And he would say that the daughters of Jerusalem are associated to the king by name only. He would say they're the servants of the king. And therefore they are unsaved, actually. They are a picture of people in the church who are not saved. They're associated, but they are not the bride. They are not a Faust. They're servants. Now, I want that clear because you can disagree with me on this next section here. But if nothing else, we're going to have a pretty lively discussion. Like I said, I had to change my own mind. So if you don't get this right in the beginning, I don't blame you, and I'm not sure if I've got it myself, quite frankly. But I do think he is correct. And the reason he says that they are not the espoused, and they are a picture of those who are servants in the church, but not espoused, is found in this verse 9, when they ask the question, what's your beloved more than any other? Okay, well, the bride's not asking that, and she's very quick to answer. But they ask the question. Now, nobody in church is going to say that. But I'm suggesting, by our pursuits, we are. That's what I'm going to suggest. By our pursuits, and what we're pursuing the most, we are saying, who is he more than any other pursuit that I have? Does he really fulfill me more than you fill in the blank? I'm suggesting that. And that hurts. Verse 9, while your beloved is certainly admirable, what is he above another? They pursue the work of the king, but they do not pursue the king himself. That is the answer, I believe. They are pursuing the work of the king, not the king for who the king is. Massive, massive difference here. And I will seek to prove it in this section here, not because I just want to prove to be right, because I would like to know what this passage means for me. I heard a famous preacher say one time this little comment. He said, we will have plenty of time to worship and praise in heaven. Right now, there's a very limited time to get the work done. And I'm going to suggest to you that is very bad theology. That is wrong. And we find it in the story of Mary and Martha. Jesus rebuked Martha because she was seeking to serve him rather than just be with him. That was the problem. That was the whole problem right there. Do we see it? Do you see how easy it is to get sidetracked with serving the king rather than the king himself at prize? I do. I do. I honestly do. I can preach a sermon and it's about the sermon, but it's not about him. The study becomes about the study, rather, right? Anybody know what I'm talking about? What's the most important thing? That was the beginning question. What really is the most important thing? Because if it's God, it ought to show. It ought to show. It ought to be obvious. And we'll see that in that last point that we're going to make. I don't really like to share personal things, but I'm going to, just to make a point. But when we just went on vacation, we go for about 3 weeks. It's not quite every year. Just our family. And I know some people think that's ridiculous. Sometimes every time before we leave, I think it's ridiculous too, but we do it. But this year I just had a little bucket list of things I wanted to do. And one thing I wanted to do is I wanted a recording, some recordings maybe of the grandchildren or something, just so that in the winter time when it is raining, when I was excited about the rain, it does happen. You can look back and say, yeah, I remember when we did this. I just thought that'd be kind of fun. And since my phone does that, I did that. And so, my wife said, I think I have a large fish on. It was just her and I fishing together, and she said, I think I have a large fish on. I thought, well, this would be a good time, and so I'll just record that. And so I recorded on my phone, and then I kind of forgot about it. I've watched it a couple times already, actually about 5 times. I don't know why it's more important to me than all the other things. And I had to think about, why is this so intriguing to me to watch this so many times? And I finally realized what it is. Because it's just a recording of two people who just really like to be together. Not the fish, not the scenery, not the boat. Just two people that really like to be together. That's it. Just enjoying each other's company. You know, that vacation started out a little bit choppy. I won't lie to you. I'm not going to paint some fairy tale to you. There's some things that happened that a lot of sleep because of a rat in the camper and some things like that, and it started out choppy. I'm not pretending to be something we're not. But I am going to say by the end of it, it was two people really enjoying each other. You know, I didn't marry my wife because she could cook, because she could clean. Didn't do it. I didn't marry my wife for anything she had. I didn't. I simply married my wife because I liked being with her. That's it. And I didn't want to be apart anymore. You know, people ask, how can you go on vacation for 3 weeks? I say, how can you not? I'm with the one I want to be with, and we're doing the things together we like to do. It's not long enough. Met a man up there, and so did Clyde. One day he just said, you know, we were up here, and we just decided, why in the world are we going home? And they never went home. They just stayed there. They just bought a house. And that was really tempting. I wish, speaking of covetousness, I mean, right? I had to, yeah, anyway, guilty already. You know, in 30 years of marriage, it'd be 30 years, December 5th. God has blended two lives together that didn't start that way. We complete each other's sentences. We laugh about the same things. We enjoy the same interests. You know, we didn't in the beginning. I'd fish and she'd read a book until I caught her cap so many times with a fly rod that she about wouldn't go fishing with me anymore. I wasn't that good at it. But it's changed. The leading cause of divorce in the United States, actually in the world, do you know what it is? 50% of them are failing. Does anybody know what the leading causes are? Lack of commitment, number one. And number two is irreconcilable differences. It's people's lives that just wouldn't blend anymore. That's why they failed. Have you ever looked up the word helpmeet in the Bible? God said he looked at all the animals and he brought them in front of Adam so that he would name them. And among all those animals that could have helped him, he said there was not a help suitable or compatible to him. And so he made a wife that was. Someone that would become compatible. And matter of fact, God said it was not good. Of all the things in his garden, it was not good that man should dwell alone. I'm going to suggest to you this morning that a servant is not compatible either. A servant is not compatible to be a bride. If we're just speaking about compatibility, a wife is meant to be compatible to man. They are to learn to walk together. They are learned to love each other. They are to learn intimacy. They are learned to be one unit according to the scriptures. A servant is way different. A servant is way different. It's not help me. A wife will serve her husband, but from a completely different motivation. In Galatians chapter 4, the argument is Abraham was to cast out the bondwoman, Hagar. This is an allegory. But her loyalty to Abraham was as a servant, and she was to go. She was a distraction from the marriage, right? Yes, the whole point of that is for the offspring and heir of the promise. I understand that. But she was to go too. He didn't just take the son out. She's a distraction as a servant to the marriage. In other words, what I'm suggesting this morning is a secretary, a servant, may actually do more work than the wife that's dedicated to her boss all day long. But she will never take a place unless something changes in that arrangement. She can't. She's on a whole different motivational level. It's for exchange. She is doing something for something. It's an exchange rate. The wife is not motivated by that at all. The wife serves the husband because she loves him and vice versa. It's an intimate relationship you would never have with a servant. Or shouldn't. It's on a completely different basis is what I'm arguing. And we'll get around to this whole thing and tie it up here. According to Ephesians chapter 5, the main point of marriage is not to raise offspring. It is not. The main purpose of marriage, according to Ephesians chapter 5, is to be an example to everyone of Christ and his church. It's a marriage. And your marriage is supposed to prove that. Two people ought to walk through life learning more and more and more to become one. And that's no different than us and Christ. Right? We're not servants. You're not called to be a servant. You're called to be a spouse to Him. He is your pursuit. Yes, you serve. But you serve from the basis of a wife. There is a massive difference. Massive difference. Because if you're a servant, you're a daughter of Jerusalem. You're not saved. According to the scriptures, and I can show you several more, and we will here in just a minute. Verse 32 of Ephesians chapter 5, Paul says, this union is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Christ and His church, on a walk, enjoying each other's company, learning to enjoy each other's company. They're pursuing each other. They're pursuing each other. What did we read in Matthew chapter 7? Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works, and I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who work iniquity. Were they servants? Absolutely. There's their list. But there's their list. But see what they're serving for? They're serving for an exchange rate. You owe us. Look what we did. Right? So they seek to justify themselves and feel they deserve a reward because of their own efforts. It's a servant-only attitude. And their disobedient iniquity proves they didn't love Him. It proves it. I'm going to show you some verses that say that when you disobey, it's proof that we don't love Him. And love that is based solely on performance is not a true love. I do not love my wife, as I said. I do not love my wife for what she does. I love my wife for who she is. That's it. I love my wife for who she is. And that's the same relationship we should have for God. I don't love Him, shouldn't love Him for what He has. It's not about heaven. It's not about heaven. It's not about what He's going to give me. I love Him for who He is. And He's very patient. Most of all. Foremost of all. He's very patient and very kind. I love Him for who He is. In other words, these folks are working to gain His favor rather than working from a source of love for Him. They wanted to impress Him. They proved them that they are servants. You know, if we work for in an exchange for favors, you know what that is? You know what that is? It's called harlotry. That's what it is. That's a problem. That's not a foundation for marriage. So the daughters of Jerusalem represent religious folks who are actually not pursuing God, who are serving for hire. In their own strength and opinion, they're still full of self and pride. While they do serve the king, they're actually seeking their own advancement. The Broad Road Christians, while the worldly Christian outlook is around, their outlook is down. Their outlook on other people is down. Because that's how a servant acts. Out of an insecure relationship. It's a boss-servant mentality. And so all they can do is outperform the next guy. And so their relationship's insecure. They're replaceable by someone who outperforms them, and so they look down on those who are not as dedicated as they feel they are. Their view of themselves is strong, proficient, important, and wise. They pursue proving their own righteousness and all they do for God. And the Pharisees fall into this camp. What did Jesus call the Pharisees? John chapter 10 said they're hirelings. They're working for hire. But when the good shepherd comes, or when the wolf comes, what do the hirelings do? They're out of here. There's no loyalty. There's no love. They do not read the Bible to pursue God. They read the Bible to prove their arguments and understandings are superior and why their reasoning is correct, even if they have to wrest the scripture. They cannot receive counsel, correction, or rebuke. They're stubborn when confronted and full of excuses and pride. Their mind is already made up on subjects, and opinions and counsel are the only way, that their opinions and counsel are the only way. Christianity is about doing, not being. They do not understand at all a walk with God or aligning themselves with Him that they might be more compatible. You don't believe it? Go ask about anybody how they feel about a two-kingdom concept. What Jesus said. What did Jesus say about two kingdoms and loving your enemies? What about divorce and remarriage? The mind's made up. Door's closed. John chapter 14, verse 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. Verse 24a, he that loveth me not, keepeth not my sayings. That's what he said. 1 John chapter 2, 3 through 5, and hereby we do know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. He that saith, I know him, and keepeth not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoso keepeth his word, in him verily the love of God is perfected. Hereby know we that we are in him, if we do what he says, at whatever it takes. Here's what he said, I'm changing my mind. That's the way it's got to be. That's the way it's got. Otherwise, we're just hireling. Guilty. Guilty. It's so easy to come from a preconceived idea, or this is what my church says. What did he say? What did he say? Because if he said it and I'm not doing it, it's proof of one thing. I don't really love him. That's what he said. Like I said, you're not going to like this sermon. A person who truly loves God will adjust their lives no matter what it takes to do what he says because they love him. We're trying to make our lives more compatible. Remember what we said in the beginning? We are to be more consecrated to what he says. Those who don't keep what he says may by all appearances serve him. But Jesus clearly says, they don't love me. And Jesus, I'm going to promise you something. I'm going to promise you something. Jesus will never marry someone who don't love him. He's not going to marry someone who doesn't love him. Why would he? Doesn't make any sense. John chapter 16, 2 and 3, they shall put you out of the synagogue. Yea, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think he doeth God's service. And all these things will they do unto you because they have not known the Father nor me. He just tells us there's coming a day where they're going to throw you out of the church and they're going to kill you, and they think that they're pleasing God because they think they're serving him. And it's not true. He says, they don't even know me. Hey, better to hear it today, right? Better to hear it today than stand, what the brothers say in the beginning, we're fast coming to a day when we're going to stand before him. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to hear, I never knew you. I don't want to hear that. Because that's a long time to think back on what I could have done. No matter how much we think we serve God, do you know him? Is he the pursuit? Is he alone the pursuit? That's the question. And are we becoming a new, compatible creature as we consecrate ourselves to him more and more? You know, when we were first married, we weren't that compatible. We liked to be together, but, I mean, let's just be honest. You don't start out your marriage the way you end your marriage, right? There's some things that you got to learn. Am I right? But it's the same thing when we come to Christ. There's some things we gotta learn. I didn't come and know it all. I didn't. There's some things I still need to learn. I'm highly guessing he wishes I would catch up pretty fast. That's why I said thank God for his patience. Okay, now the fairest among women. We're gonna go really fast here. I'm gonna turn back to Song of Solomon. You don't have to here. I'm just gonna have it in front of me. I'm not really gonna read it. But when they ask the question, what is your beloved more than another, O thou fairest among women, it doesn't take this lady 2 seconds before she's answering the question of who her beloved is. I mean, there is no question. She is describing him in terms that ought to make us blush. But I mean, she knows what she likes. And it really disturbed me before, there in that first section of this book, because I can never understand, is this a dream that she's in when it talks about him leaving and everything? And now I've decided, you know what, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because I'm going to tell you a secret. If that is a dream, it is proof that she loves him with all of her mind, because she's even dreaming about him. And so I think if it's a dream, it doesn't even matter. This guy cannot get out of her mind. He's got her, right? He's got her all the way. And that's what Jesus wants from us. All the way, no matter what. And when somebody says, what's your beloved more than another? I'll tell you. And it might be just like that blind man that was on the wayside. He said, who's this one that made you see? And he says, all I know is I was blind And now I see. And maybe that's all your only testimony. But there ought to be a testimony of who he is. Of who he is and how much he means to you. Right? Or what is he more than anything else? If I could tell you more about my tractor or my truck or my other stuff, there's a problem. There's a problem if I can't tell you more about who he is. To me, he's the fairest. He's the best. Look how far he came for me. And look what a mess I've made of the whole thing. And he still loves me. Name somebody else like that. Oh, let's turn over into chapter 6. Let me just read a couple of verses here. It says, set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm, for love is strong as death, as strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are the coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would be utterly be despised. That's how much she loves him. There is no comparison. You couldn't give me enough money. Do I love him like that? I was single on him, and I wouldn't take any exchange rate at all. Wouldn't even consider it. Everything else is peripheral. And so, the other two views, one was gazing around. The other one was gazing down because they're serving and they're looking down on everybody else. There is no question that the gaze of this woman is up. She only has one thing in mind, and it's him. It's just him. Everything else is peripheral. Their view of themselves of these type of Christians is needy, dependent, yearning, and longing. I'm going to ask you again, what is the most important thing in your life? What is it? Tozer, we are created by God to worship and enjoy him forever. And I'm going to suggest to you that alone is the most important thing. That's it. We are created to worship him and enjoy him forever. There's your answer. Everything else that is a distraction to this pursuit needs to go. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, what they call the myth of marriage. It was written by a doctor, Dr. J. Allen Peterson wrote it this way. He says, most people get married believing a myth. They believe that marriage is a beautiful box full of things they've longed for. Companionship, intimacy, friendship, etc. The truth is that marriage at the start is an empty box. You must put something in it before you can take anything out. There's no love in marriage. Love is in people. And people put the love in marriage. There's no romance in marriage. You have to infuse that into your marriage. A couple must learn the art and form the habit of giving, loving, serving, praising, and keeping the box full. If you take more out of the box than you put in, your box will be empty. Now, I want to think about that from a spiritual standpoint. We're talking about Christ and his church and your loving pursuit of him. And I'm going to suggest to you that that's exactly how it is. You can't take something out of a box if you put nothing in. If you've got no spiritual walk and you're expecting to know the promises of God and you've never picked up this book, you're not going to have it. You can't. You can only take out of the box what you put in. And if you didn't put any time in, you're getting nothing out. Where's it going to come from? If we don't read our Bible, how in the world can you have a relationship with someone you don't talk to? It's impossible. It's impossible. If you're expecting to cross over the line of death and stand before this God and you've got no clue who he is and never talked to him and you expect a reward, that is the loftiest dream I've ever heard of. That's profound. Matter of fact, it's impossible. Because the answer is, I never knew you. We never talked. We never walked. Who are you? We have to start filling our box with spiritual things. You cannot be consecrated to someone you don't know. How would you do it? Consecrated how? It's impossible. It's illogical. It doesn't even make sense. My wife and I lived in separate houses. I couldn't stand up and tell you that we enjoy each other's company. I don't know who she is. James chapter 4, verse 8, he speaks along those lines, I think. He says, draw nigh unto God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. In other words, he's saying God is willing and waiting to match your pursuits. You pursue him, you draw nigh to him, you cleanse your heart, you change your mind, you put your double mind back on him, single focus, he'll meet you. That's the promise. He will meet you with that. Wherever we've been, what we've been trusting in, what we've been pursuing, you have the promise that if you'll step close to him, he'll step close to you. You talk about a patient God. You talk about a God like no other. You talk about a shame that we've even thought about anything else. And so number one, learn to enjoy his company. Make it a priority in your life to pursue him alone. If you're going to be the fairest among women to him, pursue him alone. And he will meet you and he will honor your choice. That's what the Bible says. He'll meet you. Wherever you're at, however long you've lived, and however long you've been doing it wrong, that's how patient he is. He's going to meet you with that pursuit. If you'll make it your effort to forget that stuff and press close to him. That's the promise of the Bible. That's number one. Number two, seek to make our lives more compatible to him. More consecrated to him. More compatible. More like him. I'm just going to very fast read some scriptures. Ephesians 5:27 speaks of that he, Jesus, might present himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but it might be holy and without blemish. Hebrews 12:14, follow, literally pursue, which is what seek meant in verse 2 of Psalm 53. There's none that seek after God. It means pursue. Follow, literally pursue peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Revelation 19:7, let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, the Lord, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. Ever seen a bride show up and she wasn't ready? Bizarre. No way! No. The wife has made herself ready. Jesus was asked what was the greatest commandment. They were tempting him. Greatest commandment was in the law. What is the most important thing? That's really what the Pharisees are after. What's the most important thing, Jesus? He said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. Everything else hangs on that. Romans chapter 13, what does it say? Love fulfills the law. Do we love him? Conclusion, there are three ways, there's two broad ways, and there's one narrow way. All professing Christians fall in these camps, I believe. Our pursuit shows clearly what our priority of life is and what's most important to us. And so am I selfishly pursuing my own desires, not satisfied with what God has given me and with him? Am I pursuing God? Number two, am I pursuing God for what I feel he should give me as an exchange for my service? Or am I pursuing God for who he is and learning daily to enjoy his presence and seeking to make my life more compatible to his as he reveals what needs change for a more consecrated life? That's the question. Psalm 91 says it this way. This is God speaking. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation.